Good morning. One of these mornings, I'm going to break out and dance to that. So I have to restrain myself up here. I'm looking through the crowd to see if anybody's getting down, but not quite yet. So we're still getting comfortable with one another here at United Church in week four, but maybe this is week one for you. And so I want to welcome you to United Church. Thank you for coming and checking us out. And we've been in the series Reimagine. We're reimagining church and God together, not because we're reinventing God together, but we're looking back to how Jesus did life, what he taught about himself, and what he taught about what it means to have a connection with God. So that's what we've been doing together. And today we're going to tap into a bold promise that Jesus makes. And it's all about this word, greatness. So when you hear the word greatness, what comes to mind? Now, actually, I want to ask you to go ahead and talk to people that you're sitting next to. Like when you hear greatness, what are some of the things? And maybe it's people, maybe there are certain things or places that come to mind when you think about great places or great people. Go ahead and say what comes to mind and just take a minute or two to talk together with those that you're sitting near. If you're not sitting next to somebody, go ahead and like move closer to somebody and have a little conversation real quick. Okay, all right. So I know some of us might not be used to talking with one another during a church service. You don't want to interrupt the person who's on stage or anything like that. It's okay. Like, it's okay to talk, but it's okay to shout out loud too, because I'm going to ask you to like shout at me right now. Don't like be angry at me, but shout at me. But tell me some of the answers that you had for greatness. What comes to mind or what came to mind? Anybody in this section over here say greatness. What came to mind?
Royalty.
Okay. Ali. Muhammad Ali. All right. So
Michael Jordan.
Anybody else? Any other takers? Anybody greatness over here?
Creation.
Say that again.
Creation.
Okay, great.
God.
Say that.
God.
That's a good, like, you can't go wrong with Jesus or God at church. Like, you say Jesus or God, like, you're good. So just about every question in church. So great. Anybody else? Greatness over here.
Tom Brady.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Good gracious. Oh, man. That you're right, though. I will concede. He is great. All right. Anybody else?
Tony the Tiger.
Frosted Flakes. All right. Somebody else said something over here?
Tremendous achievement.
That's right. All right. Okay. So greatness. So when we think of greatness, I think a lot of us think on the same wavelength, like how many championships did an athlete accomplish? Or how many albums did a group sell? You know, the more albums they sold, the greater they are. And we think of greatness in those terms. So at Discover United, if you come today for our Discover United experience, you're going to hear the story of United and how we came to be and what we're about, and we'd be glad to have you, if you didn't sign up, join us for Discover United this afternoon. But we had 5 monthly meetings starting in April. Every month we met once a month because a question we would get all the time is like, what kind of church are you? And it was really a weird question to answer because it's like, I don't really know what kind of church we are because we're still just forming. And we're still trying to figure out like who's a part of our church. I know some of the core beliefs that we have as a church, but what kind of church? Like, we didn't meet on a Sunday yet, so we didn't have any music, we didn't take communion together, we didn't have any different types of groups yet, so it was hard to always answer that question, but we tried to, in those monthly meetings, talk about the kind of culture and church that we're going to be, and one of the things we talked about is what we're actually talking about today, about this word greatness, because I told our team that was with us already, I said, I want to be the greatest church ever. Like, what? Start exit the doors, like, that's kind of a bold statement, you know, like I would say, yeah, I want to be the greatest church. I want you to be the greatest Christians that ever lived and walked the face of the earth because of your experience here at United. And how that sits with you, probably a little uncomfortable, a little like, where's he going with this? It's because of all how we define greatness. Because of how we think of greatness, it's that person with the most wins or the person with the biggest bank account or the person that has the most employees that works for them. Like, they're great, right? Well, Jesus actually redefines greatness. Like, and I mean that. He literally redefines it. And I want to talk about that because I think if we understand why he redefines greatness and why it's important to us, it could revolutionize the way we think about winning in life. Meaning, you might be here this morning and you might think, I'm a huge failure. I have not measured up. Well, let's take a look at what Jesus says about what does it mean to win in life? What does it mean to succeed? What does it mean to have fullness of life? We've talked about that a little bit last week, having fullness of life, but today really gets at fullness of life. And it's about greatness, and it's about contrasting two different ways of thinking about greatness. And one scene that I can think of a movie that illustrates this really well is from the movie 300. Has anybody here ever seen the movie 300? And so 300, you've probably seen the character Gerard Butler, who is Leonidas. He is the leader of the Greeks, or the Spartans. Does anybody know why it's called 300? Because there's 300, what warriors? Spartan warriors. I already gave the answer away just a sentence or two ago, but Spartan warriors. And he leads 300 Spartan warriors into battle against a quarter of a million Persians. So that doesn't seem fair at all, does it? And the contrast between Leonidas, who is the leader of this army, to Xerxes, who's the leader of the Persians. We have a picture of Xerxes from this movie, if you haven't seen the movie. And he's this king who sits on this throne. He's got gold literally adorning him. He's got gold boots. He has this throne that he sits on. If you haven't seen the throne, he sits on this throne because he's always elevated. He's always higher than everybody else as the king of Persia. And he's more important. In fact, when his throne is mobile. He moves on his throne, and it's mobile because of about 100 men that carry him on this throne. So we have this picture that you can see of this throne where men carry him in the movie, so he can always stay elevated. But in this scene here, you see Leonidas there in the lower left-hand corner, and then you see Xerxes at the top. He walks down his throne to come talk to Leonidas. And when he walks down, you might say, like, well, how is he going to get off of his throne? Because there's like a 5-foot clearance there that he has to get down. Well, some of those men come out and they form steps, and he just walks on men down to meet Leonidas. And there's this interaction that is so poignant about the difference of greatness that we're getting at this morning. It's this. Xerxes comes down and he talks to Leonidas and he says, in the face of annihilation and the presence of a god, meaning you're going to get destroyed, you're outnumbered, and then you're in the presence of me. I'm a god. It isn't wise to stand against me. Imagine what horrible fate awaits my enemies when I would gladly kill my own men for victory. And then Leonidas quickly responds, and I would die for any of mine. And there's the difference. There's the difference of greatness. Xerxes has many slaves that he uses for his own glory to make his name great, and Leonidas has few warriors, but he would lay down his life for every single one of them, not considering himself greater than them. In battle, Xerxes, he heads up into the hills, almost like the nosebleed section of a football game, and he watches the war take place. And Leonidas is on the front line with the 300 Spartans in war. Xerxes is distant, and he sees his men as pawns for his own glory and satisfaction. And Leonidas, he's with his men. He fights with them, and he lays down his life for them. What king would you rather go to battle for? Who would you really rather fight with? Yeah. Well, you're not fighting with Xerxes because he's watching. So you can't even really answer Xerxes because he doesn't battle. Unless you wanted to be a coward like him and pull away and watch. See, in a much greater way, like Leonidas, Jesus became flesh and blood. He lived among men that he led. He slept in living room floors with his comrades. He went fishing with them and ultimately gave up his life for them. And Jesus is teaching and modeling greatness that brings fulfillment to us if we embrace it. That's completely different than how we would define greatness typically and how we would see great kings or royalty be great. And he gets at this in two different interactions that he has with some of his disciples. Those are his closest friends and followers. And we're going to take a look at that. So if you grab the Bible on the way in, you can open up to page 477, and you're going to find yourself in a book of the Bible called Mark. And Mark is a gentleman who wrote about the life of Jesus Christ, and you're going to be in chapter 9 of Mark. If you don't have a Bible with you or on your phone, don't worry, we'll have it on the screen for you. And what's happening in this first scene is that Jesus is on a road trip with his disciples. Anybody here ever go on a road trip? So probably not like Jesus because it's a long walk, but he's walking with his buddies and his buddies are chatting. The disciples are talking, and what they're talking about is they're not just having a conversation, they're actually arguing about something. They're arguing about which one of them is going to be the greatest. Like, hey, which one of us is the greatest disciple or follower of Jesus? And they're in a literal argument about it. You've probably seen or been a part of arguing, but this is the dream team that Jesus has gathered, and they're all worried about which one of us is the best. And Jesus kind of gets wind of the conversation, and he kind of pulls them aside. And I don't know if you've ever been in a conversation where you're talking about something, maybe you shouldn't be, and somebody walks in, like, you're zipped, and you shut up real quick, and that's kind of like the experience they have right now. Hey, be quiet, Jesus is here. And he already knows what they're talking about, though. And they kind of know that they're in trouble. He actually tells them to sit down, and it's like, oh no, it's like one of those moments where we're going to be in trouble. And this is what Jesus says. He sat down, and he called the 12, and he said to them, if anyone would be first. Now you see the dots there. There's another phrase, but this is a shocking statement alone. Meaning, Jesus knows they're talking about wanting to be first, wanting to be the best. And what's interesting is what he doesn't do here. He doesn't say, how could you talk about being the best? What's wrong with you? Are you proud or ignorant or arrogant? He doesn't rebuke them or get upset with them, slap them upside the head, or do whatever he would to kind of rebuke his disciples. He says, if you want to be first, meaning he's actually going to help them be first. You ever think about that? Jesus is going to help his disciples be first. And this is what he says. And so if you want to be first, you must be last of all and servant of all. So what I love is Jesus does not correct their desire for greatness. He redirects it to think differently about greatness. And he's saying, don't worry about climbing up the ladder, whether it's a social ladder, a work or career ladder, or Facebook ladder, or whatever ladder in life where you want to climb up the rungs of the ladder to be better. He's like, don't worry about being at the bottom. And not only that, stay at the bottom, because I want you to help other people get up the ladder. Greatness is staying at the bottom of the ladder and helping other people climb up the ladder. He totally is rethinking what all of us, even 2,000 years ago, thought greatness looked like. But his disciples don't really get it. They were slow, like me, and maybe some of you. They're a little slow to get some of the concepts that Jesus is introducing. And just a chapter later, in Mark 10, we see his disciples again kind of jockeying for position. Like, all right, which one of us is? I mean, it's not much later, and they still don't get it. And in particular, this story, there's two guys named James and John, two of his disciples and close friends, and they come to him, they pull Jesus aside, and like, hey, Jesus, like, we recognize that you're becoming more popular, like Xerxes, and they've known greatness to always be on a throne, and they're thinking, like, Jesus is going to be on a throne one day, and he's going to be sitting up there with people worshiping him and giving glory to him, and he's going to be the man, he's going to, like, bring great peace and restore our world together, and can we be at your right hand and left hand on that throne with you? So that's what they're asking him. They're saying, we want to be right there with you. Like, just can you save a spot for us when that day comes? And let's look at what Jesus responds in Mark 10:42 with this happening. He calls them to him and he said to them, meaning, all right, hold on a second, James and John, hold that thought. I'm going to bring the other guys in for the room now or two. I'm like, oh no, gosh, they're embarrassed now. Like, they're going to find out what they said. You know, Jesus doesn't tell all the disciples what James and John said, so it's only a moment that James and John know about, but the other disciples come in for another teaching moment, because he said, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them, much like Xerxes. But it shall not be so among you, meaning you're my friends, and we live differently. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. I just so love what Jesus does in these interactions. There's actually a third one where it's the same pattern, where the disciples make fools of themselves, and Jesus teaches the same concept, and they want to be great. But I love what Jesus does. He doesn't get angry with them. He doesn't rebuke them. He doesn't correct them. He's just saying, like, this desire that you have, it's a great desire, and I want you to fulfill that. But there's just a different way that we do that. And instead of making a name for yourself, we're going to be people that make a name for other people. So for the people that we do life with, and ultimately, we're going to make a name for God. We're going to make a name for this great God. So the right answer that was given, God, who's great? God is great. Yeah. and we're going to make a name for him to be great. That's what Jesus is all about. And so he redefines greatness this way by saying greatness is not defined by being served, meaning who waits on me, who helps me, but greatness is defined by serving others. So in a culture, in a day and age where we see greatness defined by how many people report to us or how many people do we have that serve us, maybe whether it's in our home or other places, how big is my company, how much money do I have, how high was my SAT score and what college did I get to, how many Instagram followers do I have or Facebook friends. See, we measure greatness in a variety of ways and we feel better about ourselves when we get more likes on a post. It's just natural. But Jesus is saying, like, don't worry about those things. Don't worry about those numbers. We measure success by the amount of people that we're helping rather than they're helping us. And the word he uses is serve. Become a servant of others. And that might be a word that's like weird, like serve. So what does that mean? How do we get our mind around serving? So you might think of different people when you think of serving. You might think of a server at a restaurant. I have a picture and a quote here from this lady here. She says, as soon as I split these checks, make some more coffee, run 3 desserts, clean up that spill, take up an order from table 5 and refill waters, yes, I'll get you that slice of lemon that you're asking for. You know, like a waiter or a waitress is like, you tell them to do something, they get it for you. They're a server or a servant. Or maybe you think of somebody like this. Anybody recognize this guy? Yeah, Jeffrey, so the butler for the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, if you ever grew up in those days, watching Will Smith in his younger years. And so a butler, they serve you. You tell them what to do and they do it. Or maybe I asked my kids this week, when you guys think about serving or a servant, what comes to mind? And they said, when you tell us to clean the house. And so they talk about it like they're Orphan Annie and their friends together. And it's like, come on, am I really like leading that kind of house here in the Wolfpack home? And so they said cleaning the house. And then also heard thought about, well, community service. And when you think about community service, it's a punishment. And so when you commit a crime, sometimes the punishment is community service. And so some people might hear service and you're like, man, so it's something you have to pay back. And these are none of the definitions that Jesus has. They all fall short of what Jesus is getting at. And what he's getting at is not just doing something or paying back something or because somebody told you to do something, you do it. He's getting at a mindset that fuels a way of life for us. In a mindset that's with these two words, others first. So the mindset that fuels our life, that we live out, others first. And it's not just here at church. Like, hey, sign up and serve at church or do some volunteer service. When I was in high school, I was in the marching band and we got volunteer community service hours for being in the marching band. It was ridiculous. Like, we're not serving the community by being in the marching band. But it was 75 hours of required community service to graduate. And that's not Jesus saying. No, this is the way I want you to think. And imagine if our world caught wind of Jesus' teaching of others first, of pushing others ahead, benefiting other people. Like, imagine if politicians got that. And we kind of giggle and laugh uncomfortably because we know that politicians aren't always doing that, even though that's what their job's supposed to be. But imagine if every politician, whatever political party or non-political party they represent, were in office and they served and they lived out their term for others first. How our world would change. Imagine if business owners that had employees work for them had that mindset, or husbands and fathers as they lead families and they have a mindset of like, I want to be others first for my wife and for my kids. Imagine siblings. We all laugh with siblings being others first. Like, oh no, brother, please help yourself to dinner first. You know, it's comical because it just doesn't happen. Like, there's a reason why there's sibling rivalry. You know, it's not at all others first. But imagine if our world, teachers, school administrators, coaches, pastors, teammates on sports teams and students in classrooms and peers cared about others before themselves, what our world would be like. The Apostle Paul is one of the first followers of Jesus that didn't personally interact with and follow Jesus Christ. He got others first, and he writes these words about being others first. He says, "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility, count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others." Doesn't others first kind of like scream from those words? Like, that's all about putting other people's needs first. He says, do nothing from selfish ambition. It's not good advice from the Apostle Paul or from Jesus Christ for us. It's a way that he wants us to live. So how do we do that? And the first way that we can do this and live others first is declare war on selfishness. See, our problem is that self-interest is 100% natural. If you're not convinced of that, show up at a preschool or daycare center with a new toy. Throw it out in the middle of the ground and see if any kids are like, oh no, you play with that first. No, they all go after it. They all want it. Go to a birthday party and watch the cake get cut. And you know, somebody's looking for the biggest piece of cake, right? And no kid is going to see the biggest piece of cake and say, you know, we got to give that to the birthday boy, right? And no, they're saying, that's what, whose piece is it? That's
mine.
Yeah, you know the drill. That's my piece. Because self-interest, it's not taught to us. It's just something that exists in our hearts. It doesn't mean like we're horrible, evil, wicked people. Like we do good things. We're capable of being and doing great things. But there's just this inclination to selfishness. You know, I was at a party one time playing basketball, and this little kid came up and he said, that's my ball. And I said, is your ball? And I said, and there's a bunch of us enjoying playing basketball, and this little kid's going to ruin our game of basketball. So I'm like, actually, it's not your ball. And it was the kid's ball. But I looked at the ball, and it said Wilson. So I, you know, that movie, Wilson. And I said, this ball belongs to Wilson. And he was like, oh, got upset, and he walked away. That story's totally not true. I made it up. But I wish it was that easy to convince a kid or to convince somebody that this is not yours. This life is not your own, even. Self-interest, it just comes naturally. I've been married for 16 years to my wife, and just a couple of months ago, I can remember this because it's a shame to me. My wife loves ice cream, and so we have ice cream pretty constantly in our house that's available. And one night, I just wanted to get some ice cream. So I got some ice cream. I'm sitting in the chair, and I'm eating some ice cream while I'm talking to my wife as she's doing some of her nighttime routine and errands, getting ready for bed. And all of a sudden, she looks over, and she notices I'm eating a bowl of ice cream. She's like, you eat a bowl of ice cream? Where'd you get that? And all of a sudden, I'm realizing, man, I'm not even the one that loves ice cream. I didn't even ask my wife if she would want to have a bowl of ice cream or invite her in. Like, I'm selfish. It's just ingrained in me. And I have to acknowledge it. So declaring war on selfishness acknowledges, like, that's the inclination that we have. So what do we do about that? We then resist the impulses of selfishness and we do the opposite. So the war on selfishness, it's not just all of a sudden, oh, I went to United Church and heard this message about, you know, living life for others or not being selfish, and now I got it. Like, it's not going to happen like that. Not even just within the hour that we're finished here and we let out. We're just not going to get it because we heard a teaching. It's going to be a habit that we build into our life of living others focused. It could be just simple things as you're late for something. And so you know that when you're late for something, you need to get to that door and get in that door. And so if somebody else is running into that door, you need to beat them to the door. But what if you just did something like, hey, you get to the door at the same time and you let them go in first? Or you're hungry at the dinner table and dinner's served and you got to serve from the same pot and you're really hungry. Haven't eaten all day because work was really busy, or you're too busy with schoolwork to eat and you just want to dig in. But others first recognizes, you know what, let me help the younger children or somebody else serve themselves first at the table. I mean, it's like small little things like that. And you're like, is that it? But it's small little things like that, that if you create a habit of thinking about other people first in your life, that'll get to bigger wins in life. I had a professor and a teacher and a writer who was one of the most godly men I ever met. And so I heard that he was at a very reputable institution in Chicago where he was a department chair. And so he was in Chicago, big city, great university. And I heard about a move that he made where he went to Phoenix to a much lesser known school, smaller, and he was just a regular professor. Like, regular professor is still pretty amazing. But compared to being a department chair of a reputable, I'm like, what happened? Like, all of us think, what happened there? You know, he must have done something wrong. And I found out what happened was that his wife had a health condition that living in the cold weather of Chicago made her very ill. And so he chose to take a demotion and to go down the ladder to to move to Phoenix, Arizona, where it was warmer. Like, probably nobody's arguing about Phoenix, Arizona compared to Chicago, but he moved there and took lesser pay, lesser significance, lesser of a role so that his wife could feel better. See, it's small little things about being others first that make big things like that happen in our life. And that's what Jesus is talking about. And you might ask, well, what about me? Like, do I ever think about myself? Like, how do I care about myself? Why should I live this way? And here's what Jesus teaches. He says, you find life when you give it away. He wants you to think about yourself. But you will find life and fulfillment when you give it away. Some of you are here because you're trying to find purpose and fulfillment in life. You've been exploring maybe different religions and teachings of different religious leaders. Maybe you're waiting for that right person to come into your life. And you feel like fulfillment's going to come when I find a spouse. Or fulfillment's going to come when we finally are able to have children. Or when I get the right job. Or we get in the right house or the right car. Or that it's always that thing that's going to happen. And then I'll be fulfilled. And that thing is right in front of you. Not me, but Jesus today. And he says, you'll find what you're looking for when you give life away. When you first look to me, and then secondly, look to other people. And Jesus is constantly detoxing his followers from the selfish impulses to find true life and meaning when we live for others and we live for him. And he says this, if any of you wants to be my follower, so if you're here and you're exploring where can I find fullness of life, we believe that Jesus offers that fullness of life. And he says, if you want to follow him, you need to turn from your selfish ways, take up your cross, and follow me. That's what it means to be a Christian. If you haven't placed your faith in Jesus Christ yet, it means acknowledging I have selfish inclinations. And all of a sudden, trusting in Jesus doesn't rid me of those. But I have them. And I want to acknowledge them, and I want to turn from them, and I want to trust in a man that loves and cares about me, Jesus Christ. And it's repenting of that and turning and trusting in Jesus Christ. But it's following him. One of the things that as I've been preparing for this Reimagined series that we're in, I've been looking very specifically at some of the things Jesus taught and did. And one of the things that I've noticed is that 5 times he tells people to believe in him. There's 20 times that he tells people to follow him. And so sometimes we can say like, oh, I believe in Jesus. That's great. But has he changed your life? Because he wants to consume you with his great love and passion that he has for you so that you would in turn express that to other people and your life would be transformed. And it's this death to self and living for others. And there's one other piece of advice that the Apostle Paul gives to us in this others first thinking. He says, have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, didn't count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant. See, in Jesus' day, when he's teaching these things and the Apostle Paul is teaching these things, a rabbi, which was Jesus was called rabbi by many of the people that looked to him as a teacher, that you would not only agree with the things that the rabbi said, but you would also conform the way that you live according to the way that he lived. And so Jesus' teaching is simple. Don't just agree and believe in me, but follow me. And this is how you can find fullness of life. And in fact, the last time Jesus was with his followers, it was the last time Jesus knew it, but his disciples and followers didn't know it. But they had a dinner together. And it was at night, and Jesus gathers together with his closest friends, and he knows that he's going to die the very next day. He knows that he'll be hung on a cross. His disciples have no clue. He's even told them multiple times, I'm going to be killed. And they're just not ready. They're not braced for it. They still don't really believe Jesus. And Jesus knows that this is his last moment to share a final words with them and maybe even a final thing that they do together. And this is what he does. He gathers his disciples for dinner and he washes their feet. Because in that culture, washing your feet was much different than just having shoes and socks on. They had sandals and they walked around in dirt and smelly crap all day. Literally. And so when you think about washing your feet, like that's what they were doing. Jesus was washing those types of feet that a servant would do. This is like never seen before in the history of a rabbi. Them getting down and kneeling before those that are their friends and washing their feet. So that's the act that he does. These are the words that he shares. He says, you call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Jesus is instructing his closest friends. He knows they're going to start the church. He knows they're going to be heroes of the faith that people are going to look up to. They're going to write the Bible. And the final words and the final thing that he does is he tells them to serve. The way that you lead is by serving, is being Leonidas, not Xerxes. See, Jesus didn't come and like cuddle with sheep all day. He was like Leonidas and a warrior and a servant. And that is strength. It is not weakness. Serving is great, not lowly. So that is what Jesus is teaching us. And then he closes with this, with his disciples. He said, now that you know these things, you're going to be blessed if you do them. So the question for us is, are we going to do them? And this is how we can do them. By serving on behalf of a cause that's bigger than us. Not building our own kingdoms, the kingdom of Tim. We're not building the kingdom of United here. We care a lot about United. But we care more about the kingdom of God. And what we want to see is the kingdom of God in this community continue to grow. If there's 10 other church plants in this area, that'll be awesome in the next year. Because the kingdom of God's growing and increasing. And we serve on behalf of a cause that's bigger than us. Are you part of that type of cause? What's the cause that you live for? What do you wake up for each day? See, there's no greater cause, I believe, than helping people have a relationship with God. There's great causes out there, don't get me wrong, but to be connected to God and have a life-giving relationship with him, there's just nothing better to be a part of. You could be a part of that here at United. You could be a part of that. There's a great churches in this community. But the question is, are you part of it? Blessed are those that just don't know these things, but actually do them as well. My story as a pastor starts with these interactions that Jesus has, the foot washing, the teachings here. There was a week-long camp that I had in my late teen years, and this was the whole theme of the week. I actually, instead of, for some reason, when my friends were going out and horseback riding and slip and slide or whatever you do at camp, I chose to be at a Bible study. And so like that was the elective. I don't know if I chose it or if by default I ended up here. The youth leader didn't like me and wanted me to go to Bible study all afternoon while all the other kids had fun. And so I was there with all the old people. You know, meaning like anybody that wasn't a teenager. And so it's me and all of these like youth leaders that are part of this Bible study. And one of the things we do is we get around and we start washing one another's feet after we read this verse together. And we do these activities. It's totally weird to me. But throughout the week, it's like these verses and what Jesus was doing was like, I want to do that. Like, that's what I want my life to be like. Like Jesus came and said that I didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many. Like, I want to be like him and do that. And so I had a desire at that point to be a pastor. But what I learned from that time to 10 years later, when I finally became a pastor full time at a church staff, was that I didn't have to wait to be a pastor to live others first. As a busboy at a restaurant in Perry Hall, as a lifeguard at the pool, as a camp counselor at a summer camp, as an admissions counselor at Towson University, I was able to be others first in all of those other areas. As a husband, as a father, as a son, as a friend, I found and have found my greatest fulfillment when I'm more focused on the needs of others instead of myself. And the opposite is true too. When I'm more consumed with myself, I'm miserable. And Jesus gives us this encouragement to think this way and to live this way. Now, how can we do this on our own strength? We can't. And we're going to take a meal in a second. And I'm not talking about the lunch meal for Discover United. It's the paradox of a meal that is a small little cup with a cracker and a cup of juice that is not going to physically nourish us at all. But this is how we live others' focus, by trusting in what this meal represents, that this brings us the greatest spiritual nourishment we can ever find in this life. Through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, we can be connected to God. And so to live others first starts here. Starts with believing and trusting that Jesus is the answer. He's the hope of the world. He's the King of Kings, the one we should all bow our knee to. See, he said he didn't come to be served, but to serve But he goes on to say, to give his life as a ransom for many. And he did that. He did that for you and for me. And for us to have this moment where we could say, not only do I want to live that way, I just want to enjoy the man who was others first for me. He was for me through his death. And we remember that by taking communion. We're going to pass communion from this side of the room all the way across the room. And in your own time, you can just go ahead and reflect on how Jesus was others first for you and celebrate that truth and that reality that you're loved by God. And this little meal, this is the fuel for you to be others first. Let's go ahead and enjoy communion together.